You're listening to PX Pulse, a regular podcast bringing you fresh voices on critical issues facing HIV prevention research today. You're listening to PX Pulse. I'm Jean Barron. The scope of vaccine research in HIV today is unprecedented. And in this episode of PX Pulse, you'll hear about three major trials that have everyone's attention. They are HVTN-702, a so-called pox protein strategy that seeks to improve on a vaccine tested in 2009 in a study known as RV-144. It showed about 30% protection, and it's the only HIV vaccine with even modest success in decades of research. Next, you'll hear a lot about HVTN-705, also called Imbicoto. It's testing a vaccine using what's termed a mosaic insert. A mosaic insert joins small fragments of HIV from different strains of the virus into a single strand. That's the insert. It's the part of the vaccine that shows the immune system what it's supposed to fight against. In this case, HIV. Finally, there's the AMP trials. They're testing the efficacy of bioengineered, broadly neutralizing antibodies. The AMP trials could lead to an entirely new HIV prevention strategy someday, and these trials will also inform research on vaccines. In this episode, four guests talked about these trials and how they're pushing the next generation of prevention. The first is Dr. Larry Khoury, who joined us from Seattle. As the principal investigator of the HIV Vaccine Trials Network, he oversees all three trials, as well as a wide portfolio of early phase vaccine research. Dr. Khoury delved into the science informing these trials, and along the way, we explain key concepts in greater detail. But before we take up what these trials are testing and what the results may mean, we asked Dr. Khoury an important question about the global commitment to research and development. In March of this year, the leader of PEPFAR, this is the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS, the world's single biggest program to address the epidemic, told Congress that, quote, "For the first time in modern history, we have the tools to change the very course of a pandemic by controlling it without a vaccine or a cure." Some have expressed concern that statements such as this undermine support for cure or vaccine research. Dr. Khoury made his case for continued investment this way.
Well, I think our energy should not be geared towards refuting these sentiments at all, because if we do, we simply lose sight of the task at hand. For us, the HIV Vaccine Trials Network, that simply is to find a globally effective HIV vaccine. The data themselves, I think, tell a pretty powerful story, and it reminds us that people around the world are still being infected with HIV, especially women. There are 1.6 million new infections a year, and even on our doorstep here in the United States, we still see between 40 and 45,000 infections per year. You know, lives are still being lost, so PEPFAR is an incredibly important program. If communities are not healthy, individuals cannot actively participate and contribute to their economies. And, you know, funding research and development is not just about caring for our communities. It's essentially a long-term investment to ensure that people thrive, economies thrive, and we create a better tomorrow. So I'd say, to me, advocacy has never been more important. Right now, one of the most important messages is to get governments and philanthropic organizations and donors to continue the long-term investment into research and development to find an effective biomedical prevention for HIV, traditionally an HIV vaccine, and afford our children the opportunity to have one less worry.
The sustained investment in research and development has brought the field to the three major trials underway today. In the following section, we share Dr. Khoury's highlights from all three trials and explain important concepts along the way. First, there's the AMP trial.
The AMP trial means antibody-mediated protection, and what it is testing a broadly reactive neutralizing antibody to prevent HIV acquisition. And that comes from the issue that, in general, neutralizing antibodies have been the type of antibody that most vaccines work by. Now, there are examples in biology, and I'll go back to my work in herpes, in which we made vaccines that developed large amounts of neutralizing antibodies in people that inhibited the virus in the test tube. But when we put it in people, it didn't work. which means that the assay we used in the test tube was not really reflective of the assay that occurs, or not the assay, but the events that occur in the body.
An assay is a test. In this case, Dr. Corey is talking about how some antibodies neutralize different kinds of HIV in the lab, but don't work the same way in the body. This is an important reason why trials happen. Things in test tubes in animals don't predict what happens in humans.
As we measure neutralization, we have these beautiful assays. Are they reflective of reality? Now, the BNAB program is a story of how an antibody that's found in an HIV-infected person can be discovered, developed, and essentially manufactured. And this is an antibody that is able to prevent the acquisition in the test tube of, you know, 80% of the strains or 90% of the strains at very reasonable concentrations. And so the AMP study is a study in which we are actually giving this antibody, and we're giving it intravenously every other month. And the reason we're giving it intravenously is that we get very high levels during the first 2 or 3 weeks, and it goes down to pretty low levels over the next 3 to 4 to 5 weeks. And the hypothesis of the study is that it is unlikely to get infected with very high concentrations, and with very low concentrations, we might get less protection.
AMP studies are hoping to show that broadly neutralizing antibodies work in humans the way they work in the lab. Antibodies bind to HIV and stop it from infecting cells. And broadly neutralizing antibodies do this to a range of HIV viral strains. The AMP trial is testing the level at which there are enough BNABs to prevent HIV infection. People in the study learn about risk, get condoms, and referrals for PrEP. But inevitably, some will still be exposed to HIV. The question is, does receiving BNABs protect them from HIV, and is it generally safe? Corey explained that frequent IV transfusions may not be realistic as a tool in and of itself, but answering this question will be a giant step for prevention science. And if it works, there will be two questions. Can scientists make antibodies easier to infuse? And can they make a vaccine that teaches the body how to make them so infusions won't be necessary?
Now, we're not saying that an IV preparation is what's going to be used for a globally effective prevention. But we know already that we've improved upon these antibodies 50-fold. We know already that we can design these antibodies so that they have very long half-lives, and we can actually essentially know that it's actually now an engineering problem, that we can actually give these antibodies by what we call a subcutaneous injection and give it only every 4 to 6 months. So if we can show that the antibodies are useful and are protective, and if we can show that and define what the level of what we call neutralization that is required for protection, and we're just hoping that the concept of neutralization will work, then we actually can move in the next set of studies to A, develop either one or two antibodies, develop in a formulation that we would give subcutaneously, and the next study would really be a product-associated study.
While AMP is testing the concept of neutralizing antibodies, Corey spelled out how the other two major trials, 705, using the mosaic insert, and 702, building on the success of RV-144, could each one day lead to a vaccine.
You know, is there a vaccine at the end of the road for HVTN 702 or 705? And the answer will be yes, depending on the data. We're looking for 50% protection over a 2-year period of time. We'd like it to be a 3-year period of time. Certainly in HVTN 705, J&J and Janssen as a company is very interested in extending the program to licensure trials if it works in women in sub-Saharan Africa. The HVTN 702 trial, RV-144, is, again, we're looking at essentially a vaccine that could be brought along. Companies are involved in that. Yes, there are some manufacturing issues that would have to be sort of solved in order to, you know, take it from, the way we made it for research purposes, into this is the way one makes it for distribution to millions of people. And those issues are starting to be involved. But both these efficacy studies are being done because there is a future and there is certainly a desirability to move those into real products.
A lot goes into these vaccines, and many different elements can be selected, modulated, combined, and tinkered with. We have prime and boosts and proteins, adjuvants, and much more. For listeners who want to learn about these terms and other ones, you can find our prevention glossary at avac.org. But Dr. Corey singles out work on vaccine inserts. Those are the copied fragments of HIV that paved the way to the trial known as HVTN-705. This is the trial using a mosaic immunogen, an innovation that puts many of the discoveries to date to the test.
Yeah, it's actually an amazing creation because it's a synthetic, you know, no strain on earth is a mosaic. It is, you know, essentially computer algorithm, then synthetic biology, synthesized sort of series of strains. Actually, there are almost four mosaics in the vaccine that are essentially designed to give a greater breadth of immune response and to make immune responses to the wide diversity of strains that are circulating globally.
As Dr. Corey talked about how discoveries in vaccine research have led to innovations such as mosaics, which, if successful, will be able to protect against multiple strains of HIV, another veteran of vaccine science talked about innovation outside the clinic and the lab. Kundai Chinyenze is the medical director at the International AIDS Vaccine Initiative, or IAVI. In a discussion with AVAC's Stacey Hanna, Dr. Chinyenze said there's a growing global commitment to work together to roll out a potential vaccine.
I think what I find amazing in 2018 and how far we've come in HIV vaccine research is how the field is beginning to come together and talk about, you know, planning for success. And what do we need to put in place to make sure that we are ready for that phase of licensing the products and rolling out to communities and making sure that governments are ready for these types of products. And not just the governments, but the communities that they are now, you know, beginning to think about what it means to have an additional tool in that prevention toolbox.
So going back to the importance of the planning that must be done if something does show protection or an efficacy signal as you describe it, you said a cross-section of organizations are coming together in a way they never have before. Could you tell me more about that? How is that happening?
So there was a recent meeting that was hosted by the WHO that brought together a lot of stakeholders, those in HIV vaccine development, you had funders, regulatory authorities represented there, as well as government organizations, to really think through the different steps if there was an efficacy signal and how we need to put in place policy and guidelines to facilitate the process so it's as quick and as seamless as possible. You talked about the AMP trial. If that, for example, was to be a product that is rolled out, what would that look like? There are no clear policies and guidelines. We also have to recognize that some of these products are complex to manufacture and are potentially in other disease areas have been found to be very expensive. So if you want to make them available for populations in need that are in low, middle income countries, what type of manufacturing, what type of products do they have to be able to enter that realm? So those are really important discussions. And I think they're definitely talking about the right things. The question now is, who are the right groups to coordinate this process?
You know, you're totally right that we, you know, this is a new time where we need to be thinking about access potentially of a licensure product. What if that product doesn't lead to licensure? What do we need to be prepared for?
This is really a time to have frank and probably accurate conversations with the community around the chances of licensure for some of these products. what will it take to get to that licensure path? Even if you have an efficacy signal, there are still several steps that have to be undertaken. And you are looking at about years before that product actually becomes available. And if, let's say, the product doesn't actually show efficacy or significant efficacy, it doesn't necessarily mean that it all has failed. Sometimes there is a lot that you learn through that process as well. So these are key things that we need to have, like frank discussions with the community, so they also have a balanced perspective of when, what to expect and when it might happen. And also, even if it does not happen, what can we still learn from the process?
And I would love to talk to you a little bit about, you know, it really feels like the nexus of HIV vaccine research right now is in Africa, and specifically in women in Africa, young women in Africa. I mean, are there things that we need to consider in terms of that being kind of the primary cohort that's being enrolled?
The field has to recognize, and has actually, I think they do recognize, the unique needs that women have. Infection rates in young women and adolescent young girls is much higher than their male counterparts. The one issue about HIV vaccines is you realize that it levels the playing field. If you look at the success that we have seen from other diseases, preventing other diseases through vaccination campaigns, you realize that if you can have that tool available for young women, you effectively put a very powerful tool in their hands, something that maybe they can access once or twice, and they would be protected for life or for many years. However, it's very important not to make HIV a disease of a certain group. This is a challenge that faces the globe, and not have the community understand it as a disease of women or a disease of young women, because that can potentially also stigmatize them. If you look at Africa, there are some pockets that also have very high rates of HIV infection. The sooner we can engage the adolescent populations, the sooner we can engage heterosexual men as broadly as the women, the sooner we can engage fishing communities and African men, men who have sex with men, that would be really valuable. Because ultimately, we want a vaccine that is not only for women, but is also for men. We would like a vaccine that is also for children and adolescents. So we do need to bring in all these different groups and be able to engage them in these trials earlier on.
Dr. Chinyenze's call for early engagement echoes the voices of HIV prevention advocates as well. Stacey Hanna also talked with two veteran advocates, Bill Snow, AVAC founder and former Global HIV Vaccine Enterprise executive director, and Matthew Rose of NMAC, formerly the National Minority AIDS Council. They both talk about the crucial role of engagement and other vital advocacy in 2018 as these efficacy trials advance. The first voice you'll hear is Matthew Rose.
We have to think about promise, design, and collaboration, but not only in terms of science, but in terms of how do we engage with community, how do we build support for a vaccine candidate, and how we go forward. So promise, I like to think about, what are we telling people? What is the community hearing about when we get them something? What does it mean? What's the time frame for something happening? I always feel like the vaccine world is so exciting for the power of a vaccine, but in terms of promise, our timeline is so much longer than all the other prevention modalities. You know, you're looking at 5-year studies and then trying to figure out what would it take to manufacture to scale. And then design, how do you design a trial in this new environment where there's a bunch of new things being added in? How do you make community understand why you designed it? And how do we find the funding for some of these bigger things? And then collaborations. I feel like we do not develop vaccines in isolation. And so while AMP is happening, while 702 and 705 are happening, how do we all kind of share things that inform each other? Because what I would hate to find is like, oh my God, you know, what if we did find some new correlates of protection? Can we inform other studies with those, or are we just locked in?
It's worth noting that we are now in a situation where the clock is ticking. Yep. And we haven't been in that situation for the last decade almost. So we know that between 2019 and 2021, we will have answers to certain important questions. So clearly, a big success would change everything in any of the three approaches that are being tested. So that's the time frame. Success in the AMP trial would involve, first of all, motion towards a passive antibody product, but there would be more trials to follow that. Success in the 702 could hypothetically lead to licensure in Southern Africa. They've spoken with the regulators there, and it's a regionally designed vaccine. The Janssen trial, which is meant to ultimately be a global vaccine, would need to move on to phase 3 trials from phase 2B trials.
This is awesome. And I think we're talking a lot right now about this sort of unprecedented level of vaccine clinical trial activity. And there's been a lot of excitement. You know, as we think about translating the results of these trials for the world, how do we temper some of the initial excitement or even the current excitement that we experience when we think about, you know, 3 efficacy trials in the field?
I'm convinced now that the most important thing that advocates can be doing is thinking about the future. It turns out that there is a pretty long road once you prove efficacy from there to having a vaccine or an antibody be available, especially to the poorer parts of the world. That requires licensure in each country. It requires recommendations from the World Health Organization. It requires massive manufacturing and pricing that's reasonable. And all of those things are huge advocacy issues. We need to start addressing them now.
And I would put in there too, Bill, kind of, we have to do work to think about what it takes to get community to buy into whatever we build.
Totally. I mean, product acceptance is a huge issue.
Look how long it took us to eradicate smallpox. We are still having fights in the U.S. over measles and mumps. And now you want to have a discussion about a topic that people still have a lot of stigma around, a lot of fear around. We can start priming the field about what does acceptability and tolerability mean? What are products coming down the pipeline? But how do we have those kind of complex community conversations as we think about the future? What do we start building now to help make things easier for us down the road? Because we know that, you know, we can already see, I mean, you've watched it happen as this field has developed. How do we start thinking about some of these roadblocks, these bodies working together and figuring things out? How do we start kind of preparing for that and preparing community for it as well?
The bodies need pressure. They need people to be saying, look, you've got to be ready when this happens. In terms of preparing communities directly, that's difficult because it's a glass half empty situation, right? There's just as much chance the results won't lead to a vaccine or an antibody product that's useful for large numbers of people as that it will. So one of the things that I think has to be done is for people in each country to have their ministers of health or their political leaders buy into the idea for whenever it happens.
So, you know, building on this, the need to understand the science, you know, in a way that we can really push it and support it. I would really love to get your thoughts on your experience, specifically the early days of HIV vaccine research advocacy. And I know this, you know, you were there for it. There's conversation about, you know, do advocates really understand the science of HIV vaccine research enough to actually be able to have some input? And I always think about how this movement was really born out of the treatment activism days. And I think about how activists and advocates dug into the science in a way where they could actually push researchers and push policymakers. Are there lessons that we need to learn about that in terms of HIV vaccine research?
So In my opinion, I was in ACT UP once upon a time. Those people never did the scientific research. They understood what was going on, and it was drugs, and drugs are simpler to understand than immunology. But what's more important is to convey a sense of urgency and not be afraid of the science. Don't hesitate to talk to scientists.
Absolutely.
They love answering questions and talking about what they do, and they really love trying to make it comprehensible to an ordinary person. Almost all of them are really willing and eager to explain things.
And I found that, you know, what's helped my career and me understand science, because I remember my first HVTN meeting, HV Vaccine Trials Network meeting, I fell asleep in a plenary because I had no idea what was going on. But over the years, I have pulled scientists aside. I've emailed people with questions. I've asked, you know, auxiliary questions. And then you start kind of piecing it together. It's, a nice puzzle, and it builds on itself. Every now and then, there's a pivot that you've got to catch up with. But as Bill said, a lot of scientists really want you to understand their findings, because to them, that means that people get it and it's not just in their heads. And so if you can take that moment at the conference, say, hey, can I pull you aside and just pick your brain? I really wanted to really get this and I wasn't quite sure what they meant here. And they love that level of inquisitiveness. And I think, you know, their field rewards the curious mind. And so they love when other curious minds ask them questions.
Whether it's new research concepts, deep, broad, and early collaboration around rollout, or advocacy for increasingly complex issues around funding and community engagement, vaccine science is moving through uncharted territory. We'd like to thank Dr. Larry Corey, Dr. Kundai Chinyenze, Bill Snow, and Matthew Rose for sharing their expertise on these pressing issues. And thanks for listening to PX Pulse.